How are you? Good. If you are within eyeshot, earshot of somebody, lean over to them and ask them this question this morning. What is a Christian? What is a Christian? Go ahead. People around you, what is a Christian? I found myself on a train earlier this year, and I don't often take public transport, but I was on a train and a gentleman boarded the train at a station and he broke the silence of the carriage. And he started to walk up and down the carriage, expressing his need for food. Could anyone help him? He needed food. He needed money. Who could help him out? And he started more generally and he progressed to more personally, going person to person. Can you help me? Do you have food? Do you have money? I'm in need of help. And person after person waved him off, dismissed him, and he was unlucky that day. No one on the train could help. So he came down fortuitously to my end of the carriage, found an empty seat and sat across from me, slumped, dejected, disappointed, with his elbows on his knees. It hadn't worked out for him in that moment. And I didn't have any food on me. I didn't have any cash. But randomly, I had a six-pack of chai teas that I just picked up. I was taking them home to my wife. And so I looked down at the chai teas and I thought, I'm a Jesus follower, and Jesus followers should look different out in public than non-Jesus followers. So what I have, I can give to this man. So I looked down at my teas and I said to him, do you want a tea? And he said, no. I re-sheathed my tea. But he knew that he had an ally in me in that moment. And so he looked up after a couple of moments of silence and he said, man, which station are you getting off at? I wonder if there's a restaurant nearby, near the station, you could buy me some food. Because I had my phone, I had a PayWave, I could buy him, but I just couldn't give him cash in the moment. So I said, sure, man, I know my station, there's a dollar pizza store, I can get you a slice of cheap pizza, I'll sort you out for lunch. And so he was thankful, got off with me. And as we're coming out of the train station, talking a little bit, hearing each other's stories, he said, you know, bro, the restaurants that are right near the train station, they tend to mark up their prices a little bit. Would you be willing to walk like one or two extra blocks for me? I know this other restaurant that we can get some cheaper food. It won't cost you any more if you've got a couple of minutes. And I said, man, I've got a few minutes. I'm happy to go a couple of blocks if you know a place. So we started walking, chatting a bit more. And he said, you know, bro, supermarkets are cheaper than restaurants. Like if you're happy, we wouldn't have to pay for like the cooking, the convenience stuff. I know a supermarket, we could just walk a little further and we could get some more bang for buck at this supermarket. And I said, look, man, we've come this far. I'm happy to go to a supermarket with you. We keep walking, keep hearing from each other, catching up. He says, bro, you know, there's supermarkets and there's supermarkets, hey. There's like the bulk ones where you can get more stuff for your money. I know this one a little further. Would you be willing to come and I could get like a bulk supply, same amount of money as you would have paid otherwise? And I said, lead the way, man. Look where we are. He was testing out my sacrificial threshold. We find ourselves in the bulk supermarket. And what do you do in that situation? I was like, I guess go find yourself some food, some drink. Let's get you sorted out for lunch. We're walking up through the fridge section together. And he sees this massive pallet in the middle of the aisle stacked with these bulk supplies of toilet paper, and it catches his eye. And he says, man, I've got an idea. If I have a friend who sometimes lets me stay at their home, and if I bring him something like this that will help his house, he'd actually let me stay there for a couple of nights. He'd give me a couple of hot meals. I'd be able to do more with the money than just a meal for right now. And I thought, look, I look at the price tag, I see $30 on these enormous slabs of toilet paper. And I thought back to the moment of offering a chai tea on the train carriage and overcome with some regret at my decision making. But I said, what am I going to do with $30 that's more important than this guy getting a few hot meals at a bed for a couple of nights? So I said, weird plan, but all right, man, grab the toilet paper. So we find ourselves at the checkout with a massive slab of toilet paper and no food. As we're beeping it through, he's got caked on mud and grease on his shirt. He's got dirty fingernails. And he says, man, if I'm going to my friend's house for a couple of nights, he's got a washing machine there. If I could grab some detergent, like some Tide Pods or something, then I could wash my clothes while I'm there. Would you mind if we threw a couple of those on with the toilet paper? Again, what's $4 or $5 to me that's more important than this man? Go, man, get the Tide Pods, get the laundry stuff. And he came back with 2 packets of laundry detergent, slides them on there. So as we beep through the goods, it tallies up to about $40. They give me the receipt, and I said, do you want the receipt, bro? And he said, sometimes the police will see me with stuff and think that I stole it. So that would actually be really helpful if I can grab that receipt. And then we parted ways and left, and I get walking back home with my chai teas in hand. And I couldn't help but think, as I realized he could spin on his heels and go cash that back in with the receipt and get my $40. And I'd probably just been conned on that train. I was a bit ashamed to go back and communicate to my wife that we were now $40 down from my decision-making on the train. But I wonder if you've ever had a moment like that where your sacrificial threshold was tested, maybe your heart hardened a little bit because of the treatment that you received. Your generosity wasn't reciprocated with gratitude like I hoped that it would have been from this man. Can you relate? So what is a Christian? What is a Christian? And I'm aware of the definitions of what a Christian is in the original language. Little Christ, apprentice to Jesus, follower of Jesus. I know what the word means, but I wonder what its working meaning is for us. What is a Christian to you? What is a Christian in practice? What does a Christian look like? And in 2021, last year, Barna Research out of the US partnered up with Alpha and World Vision, who are across the road from us here, to do some research of 24,870 teenagers on the topic of Bible, Jesus, and impact. And some of the findings they found was that the young people that identified as Christian used this title, this name to describe themselves. 50% of them used the Christian Bible more than once a month. And 50% of them used the Christian Bible once a month or less. 44%, 2 in every 5 Christian teens are using the Christian Bible 3 or 4 times a year or less. 3 of 5 Christian teens have not made a personal decision to follow Jesus. What is a Christian? Understandably, young people report to looking to their family and their communities more than the Bible to understand and learn about Jesus. And the research has surmised that just as much as asking of Christianity, is it true, the next generation are asking, is it good? Show me that it is good. And a challenge for our moment in time is the detachment of identity classifications, in this instance, the word Christian, from the characteristics that identity statement used to describe, namely profession of faith in Jesus, a personal relationship with Jesus, engaging with Scripture and letting God guide you through that, a life of prayer. There's a detachment from the title Christian and from the actions that follow. And a tension is growing that we can call cultural Christianity, detached from these basic practices from the word used. If faith is more caught than taught, what are we throwing? What's the next generation seeing from you and I? What is a Christian? This is a snapshot. To examine the Christianity that we may be passing, Mark Sayers on the Rebuilders podcast explained a natural occurrence that takes place over generations. What one generation builds through sacrifice, the next generation maintains, the next generation assumes, the next generation neglects, and the next generation buries. And to my absolute shame, on Friday it was Remembrance Day. And if you're watching online from outside Australia, Remembrance Day is the day, the 11th of November, in the Commonwealth states where we remember the fallen military people across time. So at 11:11, I'm in Forest Hill Chase about 5 years ago during the moment of silence on Remembrance Day time, completely oblivious to the time of the morning, and I'm on my phone. And I'm walking through the shopping centre and I start to realise while talking out loud on my phone that there are men and women that have stopped in the middle of the shopping centre, mostly older than me, taking their hats off their head, put it over their heart. They're remembering the sacrifice that got us here and responding with gratitude. And I felt shame in that moment, realised, hung up the phone and engaged with it. But I was an exemplar in that moment of someone who has assumed or neglected to acknowledge the builders, the sacrifices that got us here. That was not a proud moment for me. I've changed my ways. I was right on it on Friday, just gone. I'm a firm believer that great cities, great societies are built when people plant trees in whose shade they will never sit. And I've discovered that it's a sign of maturity to acknowledge the builders, the sacrifices, what has gone before us, and respond with gratitude. So in the context of what is a Christian, what have we inherited, what are we building, let's look at our text. Luke chapter 7. One of the Pharisees asked Jesus to eat with him, and Jesus went into the Pharisee's house and reclined at table. Now for some context, at this moment in time, Jesus, right before this in chapter 7, he just said the word and a Roman centurion's servant who was on their deathbed was healed and raised up. He'd gone and touched the bier at a funeral procession and the dead person was raised from the dead. People started to see these miraculous signs that Jesus was doing and they said, a great prophet has arisen among us. They started to see what was happening and credit Jesus with his rightful identity. Jesus had said, John the Baptist, this guy proclaiming like a prophet, the Messiah is coming. He said, John the Baptist is the one from the Old Testament that's preparing the way for the Messiah. And Jesus had said to John's disciples, I am he that you've been waiting for. This messianic stirrings were starting to happen. And so the Pharisees, whose house we're in today, they were the people who were trying to uphold the religious law. They were trying to distance themselves from sin. They were kind of the leaders, the militant religious leaders, really strict adherence to the law. And they were monitoring this stirring that was starting to happen around Jesus, around this disruptive rabbi who was teaching with fresh wisdom and performing miraculous signs and healings, but was disobedient to basic Jewish laws like strict Sabbath observance. And he was making these blasphemous claims like the forgiveness of sins, which belongs to God alone. So that's some of the context that Jesus is invited to this Pharisee's house. Jesus, in their eyes, might have been like the neglecting and barrier of the Jewish tradition that they were trying to build and maintain. Commentators believe this dinner was part of a symposium, which is a Greek practice where we'd come together for dinner and we'd have a specific topic that we're trying to nut out together. This would be like a lively discussion where questions were thrown. There would be a back and forth after the food was consumed. People would lie at the table with their left arm on the cushion and eating with their right hand. And the topic at this particular symposium, I can imagine, would have been the identity of Jesus. He proclaims to be the Messiah, if not a prophet. He's doing these profound things. Let's get to the bottom of this with the religious leaders. Who is this man? What is he saying? Let's throw some questions at him. This is like a formal grilling amongst the leaders of the day. Was he a blasphemer? And behold, a woman of the city who was a sinner, when she learned that Jesus was reclining at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment. This would have probably been her dowry, the payment for her marriage or in preparation for her funeral. It would be an expensive flask that she's brought. And standing behind him at his feet, remember his feet are out behind him at the table, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head and kissed his feet and anointed them with the expensive ointment. You had to crack this bottle open and it couldn't be resealed once open. So when the Pharisees who had invited him saw this, the Pharisee who'd invited him, Simon, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, we now have the context that there's a stirring that this is a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who's touching him, for she's a sinner. And in effect, the subtext is, if this man were a prophet, he would think and act like we think and act as the religious people. Therefore, he's not. He can't be a prophet. The late, great Gordon Fee, who just passed away about 10 days ago, says it like this: the invitation to the Pharisee's house was not to be considered as being in honor of a visiting famous rabbi. The failure to offer Jesus even the common hospitality of the day was surely intended as something of a put down. When the town prostitute finds her way into the presence of the diners and makes a fool of herself over Jesus by washing his feet with her tears and wiping them with her hair, it only fortifies the Pharisee's suspicions Jesus could not be a prophet, and leave uncondemned this kind of public disgrace. So what do we know of this woman? There are four accounts in the Gospels, one in each Gospel, of a woman anointing and washing Jesus' feet. And in Matthew, Mark, and John, we know that this happens in Bethany, and the woman is named as Mary, and this happens in the house of Simon, a leper. Luke's account, the one we're looking at today, is the one that differs. It also happened in the house of someone named Simon, but that was a very common name for the time, and he was a Pharisee. And we can't confuse the two Simons, because the uncleanness of a leper and the separation from uncleanness of a Pharisee, those two things couldn't mesh. So Luke's account, we don't actually know much about this woman. She remains unnamed. We know that she was a sinful woman. That's basically all we know of her. She comes before Jesus with an alabaster flask. So we know that she's had something to do with Jesus before. Commentators note, by the way, that we shouldn't be troubled by the fact that there's two different accounts here that seem to have contradictory turns, but rather we should ask the question why they're not 200 accounts, given the reputation this shows Jesus was developing among the broken and the marginalized, that he was rehumanizing forgiving of their sins. So the fact that she brought this flask, it tells us she'd seen Jesus before. She wasn't coming with this in her pocket. This is a precious treasure. You wouldn't carry it around with you. So this is maybe a public display, we can read into it, of a private interaction that's already happened outside of this meal between this woman and Jesus. And she's carried a reputation of deliberate moral compromise, and was known as such. It would be like a known criminal, like a tax collector in their day, or like a known criminal in our day, where everyone knows what you've done, what you chose to do, and you carry the shame of that in your society, in your town with you. And the woman intends, as she comes to this symposium dinner, to anoint Jesus. But she finds herself before him overcome. She starts to weep before she can even get the bottle open. And some commentators point out that in the context of the symposium, the woman who Jesus loved was causing a scene. She let her hair down, which is something you'd only really do in your bedroom. It might be akin in our day to undressing to wash Jesus' feet. And Simon says to himself, if this man was a prophet, he'd know that this woman shouldn't be touching him, because Pharisees were big on separation from sinfulness. And Jesus answering him, notice that the Pharisee said to himself, and Jesus answers him. Interesting, hey. Simon, I have something to say to you. And he said, say it, teacher. A certain money lender had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii, which is a couple of years of wage, and the other 50, which is a couple of months of wage. When they couldn't pay, he canceled the debt of both. Now, which of them will love him more? He asked Simon this question. Simon answers, the one, I suppose, for whom he cancelled the larger debt. I love the suppose, because it's like he knows that he's getting into a Socratic question. He doesn't want to be caught out in front of his friends, so he just keeps a healthy distance from his answer. And he said to him, you judge rightly, Jesus said back. And turning toward the woman, Jesus said to Simon, do you see this woman? Do you see this woman? I entered your house, you gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she's not ceased to kiss my feet. You didn't anoint my head with oil, but she's anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But he who's forgiven little loves little. Or there's clarity in N.T. Wright's translation, which I love. So the conclusion I draw is this. She must have been forgiven many sins. Her great love proves it. But if someone's been forgiven only a little, they will love only a little. Rich Lusk, a pastor from the US, says the line in this passage is not between sinners and the righteous as Simon would have it, the Pharisee. Rather, the line is between sinners who know and admit they're sinners, like the woman, and sinners who continue on in arrogant and willful blindness to their sinfulness, like Simon. Now, if we simply close the message there, and we said, we want to be more like the woman. Let us be more like the sacrificial woman, pouring out what's valuable to us at the feet of Jesus, because he is worthy. If you've lost sight of your sinfulness, then walk in a way that your sin is ever before you. We should have more gratitude toward Jesus. We should be doing better. We might leave here impassioned, emboldened. It might be a high, passionate moment, which would get us out there for an hour or two or a day or two. Sammy and I are in youth ministry. We know the passionate response very well. But what would it do after the passion wears off? It's unsustainable to hope to live at a highly emotional, sacrificial level 24/7. And so I love what Jesus goes on to do and say to this woman. Jesus dismisses her. He doesn't keep her in her shattered repentance, but he stands her to her feet. He reminds her of her status and he sends her out. He physically orients her body back toward the town or the city that she came from and says, go in peace. What does her much love lead to once Jesus releases her? What does she do tomorrow morning? I'd like to know, where is she in 12 months' time? Where is she in 10 years' time? What does her much love, her gratitude toward Jesus, what does that lead to once that sacrificial, high, passionate, emotional moment has worn off? And I imagine she followed Jesus. I imagine she walked around with him, heard from his teaching, saw how he lived, picked up some of his life and translated that somehow. I imagine that her love for Jesus was channeled toward her town, the people around her, probably starting with those that are like her, probably starting with the broken, the outcast from society, the marginalized. She said, look at my life, look at what happened to me. This can be you too. This is the man Jesus, making introductions. Her love for Jesus was channeled outwardly. And then it probably went to her family, her friends, whoever hadn't cut her out, whoever would listen. I imagine her gratitude for Jesus turned into love for others. So being released from that profound moment, she can't stay in that state, nor can you and I. Jesus said, now go out and work out your salvation in the everyday. Orient yourself back toward your town. Now begins the challenge of operating in a new status. Now, my wife and I, a number of years ago, had an opportunity to get away to like a conference for a week. And it was for Christians that were heading into industry, so that weren't working in churches, that were working in industry. And the idea of the conference was we would hear from industry professionals, industry leaders who were Christian, and they'd give some real-life scenarios, real-life stories of things they'd faced. And then they'd give it to us as the young adults around these round tables. And we'd discuss, as a follower of Jesus, what does the outworking of our faith look like in this real life industry scenario? And so this guy from another continent, running a business in another continent, got up there and he tried to start up a financial institution that was run with the principles of Jesus. And so he wanted to do things differently in how they lent money and how they did interest and how they recouped their losses, that sort of thing. So he was saying, this is my industry. And he told us a story of a local pastor who had borrowed a large sum of money from him, millions of dollars. And this pastor had squandered the money. He'd run away from the lenders. He tried to make himself hard to find. He'd lied about it. He hadn't done right by this institution. And then the industry leader said to us in our roundtables, all right, here's the situation. What would you do? What would the outworking of your faith look like? You're Jesus people. What would you do? And so we started chatting in our round tables and we said, like, Jesus is forgiving. Would he have forgiven the debt of the man, millions of dollars? Is that where we go as followers of Jesus? Is that how the outworking of our faith should be in this situation? And then we moved on to, well, he's a pastor, this guy that borrowed the money. He should be held to a higher account of character. It wasn't a mistake that he made. He intentionally misled, he squandered the money, he used it poorly. We should make an example of him before the church, before his church. We should really take him to the cleaners, strap him up and you know, sue him for all he's worth. We should really make an example of this guy. And so when the industry leader started getting feedback from the tables, this was the sentiment, quite venomous in the room, where the young adults calling out, this is so wrong, like we should make an example of this guy. He should not be able to continue on in ministry, like he should be in jail, he should be bankrupt, all this stuff about his family. And then the industry leader who'd taken and exhausted all the responses welcomed up the pastor to the platform. And he said, here's the man from the story. And he'd been sitting there hearing all of these Jesus followers' venomous responses. And he went on to tell us about how they had worked it out, how he as a Christian had worked it out and the partnership they'd now come to and how he was going to work off his debt and what they were doing going forward. And we walked out of that room differently because everything changes when you see the man. He's no longer a title, no longer a fictitious character or a principal in a brainstorm. Everything changes when you see the man. Brian Lawrence says, proximity, closeness to people breeds empathy, but distance breeds suspicion. The sinful woman in our scenario entered the room, jumped up on the platform. We saw the woman. I see it in my life when I don't have proximity to the work of God in people's lives, when I'm not hearing people's stories, when I'm not amongst people, when I don't have proximity and empathy building. I notice that, and I feel like the distance from people shapes me. I can feel that happening in my own life. I wonder if you can too. May we ever be experiencing and hearing the fresh stories of Jesus' transformation of people's lives in our context and in our lives. And I want to show you one of those stories. As we said, Sam and I are youth pastors here at the Burwood East campus. I want to show you a story of Alana. She was baptized 8 days ago on Friday night here in the room. And she's a living example, a living story of an encounter with Jesus. She shared this. She got baptized alongside Ellie, another girl you'll see on the screen. But this is Alana's story, and I just want you to hear her testimony of her encounter with Jesus and her baptism. So turn your eyes to the screen.
So as you know, my name is Alana, and I grew up in a Christian household, and I started developing my relationship with God in primary school, and I started understanding the presence of the Holy Spirit. But my relationship with God started to drift in year 8, 2019, when I got into an unhealthy relationship, and I was introduced to toxic patterns and behaviours. Through this relationship, I lost a lot of my self-esteem and self-confidence. I started placing my value and identity in that person rather than God, and through losing my self-confidence, I developed an undiagnosed eating disorder and I had unhealthy thoughts around food. Early 2020, when the relationship ended, I felt like I was carrying so much weight on my shoulders, and I felt like I couldn't tell anyone as I had developed trust issues. I'm trying to carry it on my own for such a long time, I had no other choice but to get closer to God. On the 13th of July 2020, I encountered Jesus in my room and I felt like his overflow of love and warmth. After I laid everything at his feet, as I was so tired of fighting the battles that I was mentally facing, I finally understood that day why Jesus died and rose again for me, and all the guilt and shame that I felt was wiped away. Although new struggles still come my way, I now have God to lean on. To God, I have been delivered from both the eating disorder and the unhealthy relationship. And I just want to encourage anyone that is battling through something, that with the sun sets free, is free indeed, as I'm a living testimony of his goodness and grace.
Was not a dry eye in the house when Alana shared that. And Ellie was baptized along her. They went and prayed with their family and friends next door here, and it was a night of celebration. Did you notice Alana channeling her positivity of what she'd received from Jesus outward? She straight away said, if there's anyone else here that's going through something like this, like my story, Jesus can make a difference. She said, who the sun sets free is free indeed. There's something about gratitude to Jesus that doesn't tend to stay private, but it's shared. So what do we do with this encounter with Jesus' story today? And I think it's a good place to finish to sit with Jesus' questions. And he asks this of Simon the Pharisee, do you see this woman? Do you see this woman? Jesus had something to teach Simon that was beyond his comfortable circle. Jesus had something to teach Simon that he couldn't learn in the context of just being with the Pharisees. He needed some proximity to somebody else. So Jesus draws his attention, puts his eyes on the woman and says, "Do you see her? Do you see this woman?" I wasn't proud of my train story that I got conned out of $40. But I was proud that a follower of Jesus on the train saw the man. I was proud that a follower of Jesus on the train didn't do what the non-followers of Jesus did, but his life showed a different outcome. Saw the man, met a need, maybe lost $40 in a con. And I remember being scared that God's first requirement of me when I decided to put him first in my life would be that he would say, sell everything and give it to the poor, because I had this crooked assumption that Jesus wanted us to be struggling financially. But I know wealthy people and I know poor people who don't have a rich heart toward God and toward others. And I know wealthy people and I know poor people who have a rich heart toward God and toward others. Did Jesus require the flask of ointment from the forgiven woman? No. Was he blessed by her sacrifice toward him? Yes. And we are still learning from her lived response to Jesus, her action now. So Jesus wants us to have rich hearts toward him and toward others. Does Jesus want me to be poor? That's not the question. Jesus wants us to have rich hearts toward him and toward others. A summary line from the Barna research of those teenagers that I showed you earlier is teens say, "Don't tell me about your faith, show me your faith. I want to see from you what Jesus has done in your life in what you do. Don't tell me about what you value, show me what you value." There's a great line which I find very challenging. "Don't tell me what you value, show me your calendar and your checkbook or your bank account and I'll show you what you value." What are we passing on, church? What is a Christian? The next generation are saying cultural Christianity will not do. I want to see the change that Jesus is making in your life. May we not be poor toward God and toward one another. So here are some thoughts as we get ready to respond. Jesus' questions to Simon: who will love more, the one who's forgiven much or forgiven little? Who will love more? The one who's forgiven much. Another question: who will love more, the one who has margin or the one who is hurried? Probably the one who has margin, who sees the people. Who will love more, the one who prays or the one who wishes they prayed more? The one who prays, I know who I want to be. Who will love more, the one who boldly obeys God or the cultural Christian? Who will love more, the humble or the prideful? The humble. Jesus asked far more questions than he answered. Did you know that? Hundreds of questions he asked, a few questions he answered. He asks us these questions and wants us to think on our own practice. What are we passing on, church? What is a Christian? What's our response to Jesus? Who will love more, the one who sees Jesus in you or the one who does not see any difference? Would you stand to your feet with me? Just in a moment of response between you and God, if you close your eyes and put your hands out before you, nothing magical about it, but just as a sign of surrender. Who do we want to be and what are we building, church? Who is Jesus to you and what does it mean to you to be a Christian? What feelings are evoked in you at the thought of making a change to your diary or your calendar in response to Jesus? Does your diary and your calendar reflect a life changed, transformed by Jesus? What feelings are evoked in you at the thought of making a change to your checkbook or your bank account that reflect a transformed life? Sacrificial or generous words that people use to describe you? We want to champion the next generation, church. We want to be people that show them and not just tell them by our word, our deed, our practice, our sacrifice, our generosity, that Jesus has made a difference in our life. We want our calendars, our finances, our checkbooks, the words that come out of our mouth to show a difference in us. We want to throw something of substance to the next generation. Examine your heart before the Lord and act accordingly. We want to pray as we raise the next generation. The future church and the world of the future, that we would be people that embody the Jesus that we profess. Do we see this woman? Do we see this man? Do we have proximity to people? Do people have access to us? What do the next generation see when they look at my life, your life? So take a moment now before God to ask the disciple this question. What's God saying and what am I going to do about it?